begins this rainy, humid, tropical-like day here on 94 WIPO Sports Radio. It is dismal out there, and it promises to be dismal all week. A good way to start the week. Yuck. What can I say? And when we come back in just a bit, we're going to be talking with Dr. Stephen Curley, surgeon extraordinaire. And he talks about in his new book his experiences with cancer patients and how it works and helps. All this and more coming up here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. More in just a bit. And we're back, and we've reestablished contact with Dr. Stephen Curley, his new book, In My Hands. Good morning, Dr. Curley.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Dr. Curley, how do you become a cancer surgeon? I don't think you heard about it in high school career day.
No, I have to admit I did not. I became interested in becoming a physician when I was an undergraduate. And then in medical school, I found that I really enjoyed and gravitated towards surgery because you could do something physically, manually, directly to help people. What led me to become a cancer surgeon is when I was a junior surgical resident, my family had the misfortune of having an 18-year-old cousin of mine diagnosed with cancer, and I unfortunately watched her die an ugly death over the next year in the university hospital where I worked. And it affected me and it angered me, and I'm still angry about cancer, and I decided I needed to do something about it.
It's got to be depressing work, though.
It's, you know, I'm going to liken it to being a baseball player. I grew up playing baseball. You know, even the greatest hitters in baseball, bat 300. They get on three out of every 10 times. But we do better than that with some cancers, less well with that than others. And nonetheless, the successes can be great. It can be tough. You know, there are bad days. There are days where I come home and I feel drained. I just feel like I've had to give way too much bad news to people. And the way I deal with that is through working out, and exercising, and doing something healthy for myself. Some of my colleagues, I think, can sometimes get into some unhealthy behaviors, and that's always the risk.
Absolutely. Cancer is the only disease I know of. It has such a major impact on families as opposed to some of the others.
Very true. You know, and the really sobering statistics are that 1 in 3 Americans will at some point in their life be diagnosed with cancer. And that means if you as an individual aren't diagnosed with cancer, you're certainly going to know somebody who's diagnosed with cancer, a family member, a friend, a coworker, maybe all of the above. And so when an individual in a family is diagnosed with cancer, everybody, their spouse, their children, their parents, is immediately thrown into turmoil. It just sort of whacks everybody.
I have to say something, Dr. Curley. If I were diagnosed with cancer and someone handed me your book, I'd throw it at them. I'm not sure that I'd want to look at such a thing as positive as it is.
And the book really came out of my desire to share stories that were realistic. Again, you know, the book doesn't have all stories with happy endings. That would be false. That would be an incorrect portrayal of modern cancer and modern cancer care. It correctly illustrates the fact that we're doing much better in some kind of cancer. And there are some people who beat the odds with state-of-the-art multidisciplinary care, surgery, medical oncology, radiation oncology, other specialists. But there are some people who still, despite being diagnosed with cancer, succumb to their cancer, but still show some sort of remarkable characteristics and teach us important lessons. So I understand your sentiment. You know, I can tell you there are patients who have told me that even though they've been cancer-free for 10 years, every time they walk in to see me or another cancer physician, walk back into the place where they were treated, a wave of nausea just sweeps over them because they remember what it was like.
What's the youngest patient you've ever treated?
2 months old.
2 months old. And the oldest?
93.
That's astounding to me, that wide range. How does a 2-month-old get cancer?
Well, that's, again, beyond comprehension. There are, you know, some children born, obviously, perhaps with genetic problems. There are some situations which are just the ultimate bad luck. I mean, imagine as a parent having the joy of having a new child and within a month or two of their being born, learning that they have a serious cancer. The 2-month-old I operated on had a rare type of liver cancer called a hepatoblastoma. We were able to successfully remove that, and that child did well. But that's not always the case. But children with cancer are just a difficult thing emotionally to deal with. I will never forget the day that child was brought to my clinic. Both of my nurses and my assistant were in tears by the end of the day. They all had children, and it just troubled them to their core.
I can certainly understand that. What was going on with the oldest?
Well, the oldest was an interesting gentleman. He was a World War II veteran. He had a rare type of cancer, again, a tumor in his liver that had started in his bile ducts and was found when he developed a little bit of upper abdominal discomfort, just didn't feel right. Went to his doctor, who could feel a mass when he palpated or pushed on his belly, and did some x-rays, and lo and behold, he had a grapefruit-sized tumor in the left lobe of his liver. So he sent him to me, and we had a long conversation. Even though this man was 93, he was living in an assisted living facility, but his mental facilities were sharp as a tack. We sat down and had some fascinating conversations about his life during World War II, and he had been involved in building a number of large buildings throughout Texas, famous buildings, and knew a lot about their history and knew a lot of people. And, you know, he was a fairly healthy guy. And I told him, look, I got to admit to you, your risks are a little bit higher, being 93, but I think you're in good enough health, we can do this. So operated on him. On the morning of post-op day 3, I walked in, he was dressed, looked at me and said, well, I'm eating, my bowels are working, I'm ready to go home. So I discharged him.
An incredible story right there. Truly. Seems to me one of the first things that happens when you get a diagnosis of cancer is you have a decision to make. Should there be an intervention, and what kind of an intervention? How do you help people make that decision?
Well, it's overwhelming to people, and because modern cancer care involves multiple specialists. So, you know, talk about the ultimate horror. You know, you've got to go and see different doctors. You have to see a surgeon and a medical oncologist who's going to talk to you about chemotherapy and perhaps a radiation oncologist who's going to talk to you about radiation treatments. And, you know, all of a sudden you're thinking, oh my gosh, you know, which do I do first and how do I start and where do I go? And so what I've learned is, first of all, if you're involved in the initial conversation with somebody to tell them, I hate to tell you this, but we've confirmed you have cancer, not much of the conversation you have after that gets remembered because you just rocked their world. So at that point, I always hand them my card and say, look, I'm going to have you come back in a few days or next week. I want you to write down all your questions or email me your questions or call me with your questions because you're going to think of a lot of things and your family's going to pepper you with questions and you're going to want to, you know, ask things. Now, if you've got somebody who's already settled, okay, I've got cancer, I need to do something about it. I'm going to do something about it. It's important for me as a physician to sit down with them and say, okay, here are the treatment options. Here's what we think will be best for you. But you are the patient. We're going to do ultimately what you decide to do. But based on the best data available, you know, this is what we think we should do. And many patients are surprised when they see me as a surgeon because not infrequently I tell them, I think you need chemotherapy first or a combination of chemotherapy and radiation first, and then you need me to do an operation. Many patients, when they see me, assume, well, this guy's going to schedule me for an operation. And we know in some types of cancer that's not the right first option. There are other options that should be considered first.
There's an even earlier question, it occurs to me, you have to ask, and I'm going to explain why I'm asking the question. I had an aunt who was 76 when she was diagnosed with lung cancer, and she decided, I've lived to 76, I had a good life, I'm not doing anything. When it's my time to go, I'll go. You ever have that happen?
Oh, multiple times. Multiple times. And so that is a decision I always respect. And what I've learned, and again, I even discuss this in some of the stories in the book, is that when a patient gets to that point, whether it's when they're first diagnosed or after, you know, we've done our best, but their cancer comes back and it keeps coming back or it's growing despite everything. And, you know, again, it's got to be realistic. These treatments have a price to the patient. There's pain from surgery. There's side effects from chemotherapy. It's not an easy road. And so when a patient comes to me and said, I'm done. I just want to enjoy my time. I want to travel with my family. I want to go see my grandkids. Whatever they say to me, I'll say, okay, I respect that. And if you have any problems, you call me or you call my colleagues. What I learned early on, when people say that to a doctor, their greatest fear is that the doctor is going to then say, well, okay, I'm done with you. And that's the worst thing you can do, because then they feel abandoned. And so I tell my patients, you know, if you have pain, if you're not feeling well, if you need some medications, call, we'll take care of it. I'll see you. I see patients back right up to the time they're ready to pass away. And make sure that they're getting whatever they need in terms of comfort and care.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Dr. Stephen Curley, MD, author of the new book, In My Hands, Compelling Stories from a Surgeon and His Patients Fighting Cancer. Be a part of the discussion. Give us a call. And on the landline, it's 1-888-729-9494. And on Bell Atlantic and Verizon, it's a free call. Excuse me, simply dial, excuse me, #94 and #94. We'll be right back. And we're back. It's Conversation. Our conversation is with Dr. Stephen Curley, MD, author of In My Hands, Compelling Stories from a Surgeon and His Patients Fighting Cancer. My name's Peter Solomon. Dr. Curley, we talked about people saying, no, I'm done. But families have a reaction to that, too. It's often in opposition to what the patient wants, isn't it?
Oh, that happens as well. So in that case, it becomes a little bit of a struggle, because you've got to bring all the parties together and say, look, we need to come to a consensus and an agreement, if it's just, even if it's just an agreement to disagree. But I've seen families just literally ripped apart by the strife that occurs when that sort of thing happens. And it can be difficult. And individuals have their own feelings about it, and some people just aren't ready to let go, and they want to try everything possible, and they want to hear that there's some new drug out there or something, and they want their loved one to be treated with whatever the newest thing is that's shown promise. And so, again, it's incumbent on me as a physician to sit down, again, often with my colleagues, and explain realistically what we can and can't do. Again, there are some patients where we may be able to offer something. There are many others where we have to say, realistically, the chance of something working is extremely small, and the chance of making the remaining time of your loved one miserable can be pretty high. And so you just have to be informative. And ultimately, I've seen some families come around where they're okay with it, and I've seen others literally almost come to blows over decisions and conversations like that, where they just aren't ready to hear it and they just can't deal with it.
It never occurred to me till just now, Dr. Curley, that one of the things you have to do as a surgeon is be part mediator, part therapist.
Oh, yeah. It used to be some of the people I trained, surgical fellows or surgical residents, used to laugh and say that, you know, you're like a psychotherapist, a family practice doctor, and a surgeon all rolled into one. The psychotherapist is because you do have to spend a great deal of time explaining, comforting, dealing with depression that patients or family members might be dealing with. That's a very common problem in cancer patients, as you know. The family practice part comes in that in surgical oncology, we're somewhat unusual as surgeons. We follow our patients for life. And I've got patients I've literally followed for almost 25 years now who, you know, somebody said, well, you've got a bad problem. You know, I don't know if that you can do much, but go see this guy. And we've been successful, and they're still around. And they've seen my kids grow up. I've seen their kids grow up. They come in, and they show me pictures of their latest family vacation and tell me about the new dog they've got. And we talk about what else is going on. And they'll tell me, oh, by the way, I've got high blood pressure now. What do you think you should do? And we talk about that, and I tell them who they should see. So, yeah, we really deal with the entire patient. As cancer clinicians and me as a cancer surgeon, even though I'm a surgical expert, I make sure that I stay up to date on other things that are going on so that I can at least provide information to patients about it.
Okay. One other question about cancer that's from my own history, and that is, while I'm cancer-free, I had the aunt with lung cancer, an uncle with brain cancer, and a father with skin cancer and prostate cancer. Does cancer run in families?
Definitely. There are some types of cancer that we know are genetic, that we know there's an extremely high risk of an individual getting cancer. One of the commercials that just played was about breast cancer. So we know that women who have a mutation in something called the BRCA gene are at a very high risk by the time they're 50, at most 60 years old, of developing breast cancer, and they can develop in both breasts. And so the current recommendation for those women is to have their breasts removed, which is a pretty shocking thing to tell a patient. They also are at an increased risk to get ovarian and uterine cancer, so obviously they sometimes get further surgery to take care of that problem, to prevent it. A group that I see quite frequently are patients who have genetic syndromes that increase their risk to develop colon cancer or liver cancers, and tell those patients the same thing. You need an operation to remove that may become malignant, because you have a 100% guarantee of developing cancer in that organ sometime early in your life. Those are obvious cases. They're a little more subtle. The clustering you just discussed in your family probably represents sort of cancers. I mean, again, one in three Americans, that means, you know, if you've got a big family, people in your family get cancer, different types. But if we talk to somebody and they say, somebody who has colon cancer, and they say, well, you know, my father had colon cancer when he was 50, my great uncle had it, and one of my great aunts, that raises a red flag for us. And looking at the family very closely, we now are able to do genetic testing, and there's some more subtle defects that we sometimes find that, again, really increase the risk. And what we start doing in that, rather than telling everybody in the family you need an operation, is we tell everybody in the family, you need a colonoscopy at an earlier age than usually recommended, and you need it every 3 years, because we want to catch this while it's still a polyp, comes cancer, and take that thing out through the scope so you never need an operation.
Amazing. Does faith make a difference in how people react to cancer in your experience? Whether you're religious
or not? I'm sorry, what was the...
Does faith, if you're a person of faith, does that make a difference?
Yes, it does. I people who seem almost serene when you're having conversations with them will look at me and say, well, I am putting this in God's hands, and I'm trusting God to go and to guide me and to take care of me. I've had other people who will say, I'm angry because I don't understand why God did this to me, in which case I tell them, God did not do this to you. God is not punishing you. This is not a plague that he has, dropped in your life because of something. And that's something to tell people that, this is an unfortunate event. Some cancers, the person is responsible for, classic example. We know that smokers get lung cancer. We now know that diet and exercise play a huge role. We know that people who don't eat healthy diets have a higher risk for types of cancer. We know that people who are overweight have a higher risk of multiple types of cancer. People come in and ask me, or I speak at community events and say, what can I do? I look out over the crowd and say, exercise, eat healthier, stop smoking, do things that are going to make that you can do to take care of your overall health.
There's an old saying, doctor, I wonder what you think of it. When Job asked God, why me? God replied, why not you? And is that sort of an approach to cancer?
Yeah. Many people feel like they're being punished now. One of the chapters in the book is about it, I hear infrequently is why me? I eat right, I exercise, I don't smoke, there's no cancer in my family. How could I be so unlucky? And the answer to that question is, it's a random event. It's unfortunate. I'm sorry you're the one that drew that card, but this is where we're at. This is what we've got. Now, together, we need to come up with a plan to fight this problem that you come up with. But it can be devastating to people. And I mentioned earlier the depression and sometimes even despair people can feel this as a cancer. That's frightening to me as a cancer surgeon, because I've seen patients who I thought had very treatable cancer, that we had a high chance of success, and they became depressed and just unwilling to sort of assist in their own care. It's almost like they willed it to do poorly. And on the other hand, I've seen people who I thought, wow, this is going to be a tough situation we've got here, who have shown such spirit, such fight, such drive, that they've either survived or literally lived 6, 7, 8 years longer than the statistics would have predicted they would live. Cuts both ways.
Absolutely. Of all the cancers that are out there, you seem to have focused in on pancreatic cancer and liver cancer. Why?
Well, people get asked me that one all the time. Those are two bad actors. We don't have great success with those two cancers currently. So there's lots of room for them. So I have focused on those both in my research and my patient care, because we do need it. Far too many patients diagnosed with those cancers still succumb to the cancers. We've learned, particularly with liver cancer, that there are tests we can do in high-risk populations people who've had hepatitis B or C virus infections to detect the cancer, to where we do have a better chance of doing an effective treatment. And then with pancreas cancer, we really need to find new treatments, new ways to diagnose the disease. Involved in projects where we're looking at that, new blood tests, new treatments, new immunes, because far too many patients succumb. So, yes, I've definitely chosen some difficult cancers to treat, but we have made progress over the course of my career. And I can say with, you know, brilliant colleagues who have done remarkable scientific studies on these types of cancers, we are slowly but surely pushing the pill, so to speak, and doing better in more and more patients.
At one point in my career, I had a boss who was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and she was a tremendous human being. And within 6 months from diagnosis, she was gone. Why is it so virulent, so fast? Do we know?
Well, and here, this is sort of the surprising information. People hear this, it stuns them. The problem with pancreatic cancer is by the time it's diagnosed, it's already spread to other organs in the majority of patients, lymph nodes or the liver, other places. Incredibly enough, to get to that point, that cancer has silently in the individual for several years before it finally caused some symptom. It pinches off the bile duct and somebody's eyes and skin turns yellow, or they develop. And so they go to their doctor and they go through the tests, and all of a sudden they get the horrible news. You have pancreatic, and it's already spread to other places. Pancreatic cancer, unfortunately, is resistant to many types of chemotherapy. And so with drugs, the best we can do is maybe buy people a few months of time. That's why we have glaring need for better treatments and better detection, really. The patients that we offer a cure with pancreatic cancer are the very small percentage that we get lucky, quite frankly, find while they're still small and contained in the pancreas, where I can go in and surgically remove it before it spreads to other organs. But that's a frighteningly small number. It's definitely single digits. And we need to diagnose that earlier rather than letting it sitting there undetected and unknown to the patient before they're suddenly diagnosed.
Let's say good morning to John from Cherry Hill. John, your question, please.
Good morning. I do have a quick question. I have pancreatic cancer in my family. I'm 50. My father passed away when he was 73, and his brother had subsequently passed away from pancreatic cancer about 15 years earlier. My father was negatively tested for the BRCA2 gene, so they had just chalked it up to a random occurrence, but my first cousin, which was my father's brother's daughter into the next generation, she developed it and passed away from it subsequently also. So in terms of early stages of testing and precautionary, just what you would suggest, I have seen a gastroenterologist from University of Pennsylvania, so they're talking about, you know, yearly ultrasounds, starting it in the next year or so. If there's any other suggestions, and have you ever heard of anyone taking the precautionary steps that you had mentioned about women removing their breasts, someone removing the pancreas? I know it would turn you into a diabetic, but and needing insulin. But is that a drastic? How drastic do you think that is? If there's a high chance in the family.
Well, that's a big operation, and it produces diabetes. And so then you have to deal for the rest of your life with the potential complications and side effects of diabetes and be a problem. So no, I do not have any experience with a patient having their pancreas removed. Unlike some of the other cancers like breast cancer, colon cancer, where we've had a specific gene or a specific set of genes where we just know that patient is going to get cancer, not been able to find that in pancreas cancer. I do have a large number of patients with the history you're talking about, two or three members of the family with pancreas cancer. We do have these. We can't find anything specific, but we say, look, there may be some gene combination of factors out there that we just haven't identified yet, and so you need to be followed closely. The annual ultrasound or an annual CT scan is the right thing to do, because every now and then, boom, 3, 4, 7 years into the follow-up of that individual, we detect them and we remove it before it becomes a problem. So that's the best we can do right now, cancer. I am involved in some studies with colleagues where we're looking at and other what we call biomarkers circulating in the blood to try and come up with a better blood test for pancreatic cancer. We're not sure we have that yet. We're testing it now. But right now, the state of the art for pancreas cancer is to do exactly recommended by your doctors at the University of Pennsylvania, which is to be screened with ultrasound or scan to see if they can detect anything in you. And I'll hope nothing ever shows up.
Right, of course, hopefully. But, okay, appreciate your input.
Thank you, John.
Happy to help.
Thank you. And you're listening to Conversation. My guest this morning here on 94 WIP, Dr. Stephen Curley, MD, author of the new book, In My Hands, Compelling Stories from a Surgeon and His Patients Fighting Cancer. My name's Peter Solomon. Doctor, is cancer on the rise? Is it on the drop? Are we holding our own? How are we doing?
So the what we call the incidence of most cancers is staying pretty stable, meaning how many people per thousand a specific type of cancer, breast cancer, lung cancer, colon cancer. There are two exceptions. There are two types of cancer that are increasing in incidence, skin cancer, melanoma. That's because more and more people are doing things like going out to the beach all the time and wearing good, you know, sun-blocking sun lotion. Or they're going to tanning salons, which sort of blows my mind. You know, you're exposing yourself to UV irradiation. No causes melanoma, all because you want to have that nice summer tan. The other one that's increasing is liver cancer, and that we know is because there are more people with hepatitis C virus, which decreases your risk of developing liver cancer. Cancer overall, we're seeing more and more patients because the population is growing every year. People are living longer. The number of people in the United States around them continues to grow. So that means that every year, more Americans are diagnosed with cancer. The population is getting bigger. The population is getting older. So it's going to become a critical problem, we believe, in the next 15 years. Because we're starting to get to the point in some parts of the country where we don't have enough physicians to take care of the patients we know are going to be diagnosed. So from a public health point of view, we miss that. We need to train more physicians who are really effective at treating cancer.
How's insurance deal with this question in your experience?
Well, for standard treatments like surgery, you know, if you tell somebody I have cancer or breast cancer, we're going to do an operation to take care of it, that's an accepted treatment. Certain chemotherapy drugs are accepted treatments. What's becoming, again, a national problem, and this, you know, crosses into politics and publicity, is the fact that more and more new drugs or therapies are being developed for cancer, but some of them are incredibly expensive. And so if a patient have insurance, or they have insurance that say only covers 80% of their care, and they're told with your kidney to use this drug, that for 6 months is going to cost $150,000, that shakes them. I mean, they go, okay, wait a minute, 80% of that gets covered. That means you're responsible for $30,000 of treatment here. How am I going to do that? And so people in desperate situations where they think, gosh, I have to take out a second mortgage, I have to take loans, I've had family fundraising events, and it always makes me despair when I see those things going on that, you know, people can't afford for the care that we offer. So that's a conversation that needs to take place in the forums to decide what are we going to do about this. It also needs to involve some of the big pharma to say, you know, you guys are making incredible profits on some of these drugs. Can we amp it back to make it more affordable for patients? I know you know there's been several stories about nefarious individuals or perhaps less than honest and good companies finding, oh, hey, we've got this drug that works really well for this cancer, and cancer patients are desperate, back up the price. That's just wrong. At every level of the word, it's just wrong. And so a means of addressing that and come up with a way to make it more affordable for people.
Do you see any hope of change coming out of Washington?
Not currently. I was involved with a friend of mine who's a cardiologist who used to work with the FDA. And in the previous administration, he and I actually sent some documents to them suggesting that, you know, we really needed work to make changes in the FDA to get new drugs for cancer approved more rapidly. And we need to come up with more cost-effective solutions. There were conversations not very far. We have engaged the current administration as well, but at this point have not received much in the way of response. I think that there is so much division politically in the country that people are forgetting very basic reality. Cancer doesn't care what your political party is. It doesn't care what your views are. It doesn't care who you are or how important you are or how unimportant you are. Cancer can strike anyone. And people need to their focus and think, you know, this is a national public health issue. We need to address this fact and forget about our other things. You know, if it seems to me, and this is, you know, admittedly personal opinion here, I'm not speaking for the cancer community. You know, it seems to me that if there were a topic that we could get people on the same page on, Republican, Democrat, it would be, you know, what can we do to treat people with cancer better, more effectively and more cost effective? That affects everybody, and so that doesn't really matter what your political leanings are.
Amen to that, certainly, sir. Who do you want to read the book?
Well, certainly I've gotten lots of very positive feedback from clinicians, doctors, nurses, other people involved in care of cancer patients. They said, you know, it really refocused them. One of the problems in cancer care is, and I mentioned this earlier in the conversation, is there is an issue with burnout. It gets hard to take care of patients with cancer. It can be depressing at times. As a physician, I have to find ways to combat that and make sure I stay healthy myself. I kind of instruct my colleagues in that all the time. I also do think it's helpful for patients or people who want to learn more about cancer to read the book, even though some of the chapters may be frightening or may, you know, be something for them to read, because there is comfort in knowing there are other people who have gone. And each chapter, as you know, is built around a different virtue or a different lesson from a patient, whether it be courage, endurance, perseverance. it really can help guide people to know that other people have dealt with it and how they dealt with it and what was effective.
Do you have a website, Dr. Curley?
I do. It's drstephencurley.blog, and I have another that is just drcurley.com.
And whether you go to his blog, to his website, or to In My Hands, Compelling Stories from a Surgeon and His Patients Fighting Cancer, Stephen Curley has a lot to say that you need to hear. Any problems getting the book? I mean, can we find you on Amazon and Barnes Noble and that kind of stuff?
All of the usual subjects, barnesandnoble.com, Amazon, available readily, all of those places.
And it's a book considering, worth considering. Thank you, Dr. Curley.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate the opportunity.
My pleasure. And you've been listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. Stay tuned for WIP Sunday. If you can't, nothing left to say, but see you soon.